Case number 12-5200, Aaron L. Schnitzler, also known as Tyson Q. Beck, appellant versus United States of America et al. For the amicus curiae, Ms. J. Jeanette, and for the appellee, Mr. Goldsmith.
Thank you, Chief Judge Garland. My name is Stephen Goldblatt. I'm a professor at Georgetown University Law Center, and I was appointed as an amicus in support of Mr. Schnitzler in this matter. With the court's permission, argument today will be presented by Megan J. Jeanette, a third-year law student at Georgetown, who will be appearing in conformity with the rules of this court.
Thank you, Mr. Goldblatt.
Thank you.
May it please the court. The only issue before the court today is whether the district court was divested of jurisdiction to consider if the government is unlawfully preventing Mr. Schnitzler from renouncing citizenship under Section 349A6. In particular, the government contended that the case was made moot when it claimed that it needed an in-person interview to assess whether Mr. Schnitzler's renunciation would be contrary to the interests of national defense. But the government confuses mootness with the merits. It is undisputed that Mr. Schnitzler has not received all of the relief that he seeks. Whether he is entitled to such relief is, of course, a different matter. Here, there's a substantial merits question of whether an in-person interview is nothing more than an attempt to avoid approving any renunciations under A6. The government's shifting justifications for the interview requirement offered in this litigation suggest that A6 is not being meaningfully enforced. Remand is warranted for the government to answer the complaint, state its policy, and produce the agency record. The district court should then evaluate whether the policy satisfies the requirements of the APA and meaningfully implements the statute. If the court concludes that it does, only then would it need to address Mr. Schnitzler's constitutional claims.
How the APA get into this?
Mr. Schnitzler's complaint should be liberally construed, and other cases that bring similar claims have construed similar prisoner complaints under the APA.
If you're right about the threshold issue, is there any occasion for us to say anything about the APA? Go to the district court and you can raise it then.
Yes, that would be a construction that the district court should give the complaint. And certainly the merits of the APA would need to be considered at the district court because only there can the agency record be produced.
With respect to the mandamus part of the claim, how do we reconcile those cases of ours that have said that when we're looking at mandamus relief, you do have to at least kind of peek at the merits because you have to establish that there's a clear and indisputable duty, correct?
Yes, under King v. Morton, whether or not there's a duty is a question for the merits, and in King, the court remanded for the district court to meaningfully consider the merits. Here, there hasn't been a meaningful consideration of the merits. There hasn't been an interpretation of what the statute requires the agency to do. Instead, there was one sentence in the opinion that stated that to the extent that the defendant, Homeland Security, had a ministerial duty to act on the plaintiff's application to renounce citizenship, which is also the relief that the plaintiff seeks from the complaint, it has done so. And so that sentence alone is not meaningful construction of the agency's duties under the statute.
Well, to the extent that the plaintiff asked for an act, that is, for a decision at all, you got a decision. Not the one you want, but you got a decision. Is that right?
The plaintiff, or Mr. Schnitzler, originally filed his complaint when the agency had done nothing.
Right.
And the fact that the agency informed him months later that it had an in-person interview requirement right. did not eliminate his request or make moot his request that the agency rule that his application is not contrary to the interests of national defense.
That's a different act. The judge construed, the district judge construed the complaint. I appreciate you think wrongly. But as requesting under mandamus that the agency act at all, the agency had just not acted at all, among other things. To the extent that part of the complaint sought an act, that is a decision, that is moot, isn't it? That has been taken care of. Now you have a decision that can be challenged on its substance. But isn't it correct that the mere failure to act element has been satisfied?
Well, I think that this gets to what Mr. Schnitzler meant when he said act. And he clarifies this in his later filings. And under Richardson, this court should consider the later filings in construing his complaint. And he states very clearly that what he was looking for was not another letter from USCIS. He'd been corresponding with the agency for years. And so to interpret that word act as asking for any decision or any response from the agency, I think wouldn't be giving the liberal construction.
What if we interpret that as one of two things he wanted? Thing one, an act, a decision, which he could challenge on the substance, and thing two, the merits, that is, a substantive grant to him of the right to renounce his citizenship. If we construe the complaint in that way, and I'm going to ask you to take a look at the complaint for one moment, A10. Under relief, state briefly exactly what you want the court to do for you. First two lines, simply, I want the United States of America to recognize that I'm not a United States citizen. That's your point, right?
Yes.
He wants finality on the question of he's not a citizen anymore. But skip a line, and then it says, compel the Attorney General of the United States to act on my request. To the extent that that is considered a separate request, that part has been satisfied, right? I don't think you have to fight this, because the judge construed the entire thing as mandamus. Your argument is that mandamus may apply to B, the second request, but it can't apply to A, the first, because there the request is not a non-discretionary act by the government. There your request is that there's an equal protection problem, there's an arbitrary and capricious problem, et cetera. But to the extent that part of the complaint was for a decision, give me at least a decision, that has been done.
Well, I think that, first, as you note, it's not required in order to receive remand for it to be understood as anything more than a response, as you noted, because he also makes claims on the merits. But when Mr. Schnitzler used the word act, the question here is what that word means. And holding his application in abeyance is not the type of act that any of his subsequent filings indicate that he was looking for. And so, yes, it is true that the agency had done nothing, even though he had been attempting to renounce since at least 2008, that they hadn't done anything on his request to renounce under A6. But that doesn't mean that the only thing he was looking for when he said act was some letter or some response from the agency. He also states later in his complaint that he quotes the UN, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and states that he's arbitrarily being deprived of his citizenship. This sounds like an APA claim as well. And as you note, the specific act that he's asking for under mandamus, whether or not that was a response from the agency, remand is still required in order for his claim to be evaluated under the APA. But it's not clear from the complaint alone. Act is a vague term in this context, but all of his filings need to be read together. That's Richardson. And here, many of his later filings state that he is not looking for another letter from USCIS. Agreeing to hold his application in abeyance is not what he was looking for when he filed the case in the district court. And I think, as you noted, liberal construction applies here. And so even if part of this case was moot, the entire case would not be moot, because, as you noted, he still has a claim that the agency in general is not enforcing the statute and is preventing him from renouncing under A6. Although the complaint is vague, there's no reason that it is entirely moot right now, because he hasn't received all of the relief he seeks. There's still something for the court to do here, and the fact that it was so narrowly construed by the district court was really the only reason that it could be considered moot. So the question of what he's legally entitled to and the merits of this case are an entirely separate matter that the district court should consider on remand, including the application of the APA, because as the brief noted, Mr. Schnitzler has many claims that invoke the authority of the agency, the reasoning that the agency gives, whether or not they've given him a justification for their policy, and all of those would need to be considered as well. Thank you.
Serve the rest of her time. Mr. Goldsmith.
May it please the Court, Aaron Goldsmith on behalf of the United States of America. Your Honor, renunciation raises a number of interesting intellectual questions, but the question before this Court is a narrow one.
Not an interesting one. Is that what you're about to tell us?
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
We have to hear it anyway.
The question is simply, did the district court properly dismiss this right. action for lack of jurisdiction? And our position is district court was properly dismissed. His statutory claim is moot because he is waiting. He is not waiting for USCIS to act. USCIS is waiting for him to act.
What does that have to do with mootness? The district court said on page 120, to the extent that the defendant Homeland Security has a ministerial duty to act on the application, it has done so. That's what you said. But that's not his claim. The part of the complaint I read to you says, simply, I want the United States of America to recognize that I am not a United States citizen. He's not asking them just to act. It wouldn't even be enough if they said, you are a United States citizen, tough luck. He said, I don't want to be a United States citizen. That's what he wants. Today he's still a United States citizen, isn't that right?
That's correct.
Well, then how is this moot?
Well, because our view is the district court correctly viewed this as seeking to compel the agency to act.
I know that's your view, but how is that consistent with the complaint the man filed? He says, I want the United States of America to recognize I am not a United States citizen. Then in the on page 853, which is his response to the defendant's document, I want to renounce citizenship while I am in prison right now. He wasn't allowed to do that, right?
That's correct.
And then on page 854, he says, the issue of this case was never the lack of response from the government in general, specifically the lack of action to recognize my renunciation. The government has not recognized his renunciation, has it?
No.
So then I don't see how it can possibly be moved.
Well, Your Honor, the problem with construing this action is one under 706-2, which is of the APA, which is what you're getting at, is there's no final agency action. There is not a final decision that a court can review, provide record review.
Well, there's two problems with that. One, we've held multiple times, final agency action is not a jurisdictional provision. It's a cause of action. District court did not say he doesn't have a cause of action, he loses on the merits. The district court just said moot. And it's not moot. If the district court had said some of the things you'd said, then we'd have a different appeal here. Right now, the man wants to renounce his citizenship. He has not been able to. I'm going to have to hear some more words as to why that's moot.
Well, because the reason he has not been allowed to do so is because his request has been held in abeyance. And the reason it's been held in abeyance is because he cannot appear for an in-person interview. And in looking at the mandamus action, we consider, as you noted, the statute, the language of the statute, to determine whether or not there's a clear indisputable duty.
But where's the words mandamus in his complaint?
It is not appear anywhere in the complaint.
Right. So why construe it as mandamus rather than as an APA?
It was styled as a 1983 cause of action. District court and government construed it as a mandamus action because he seemed to be, the focal point was he wanted to compel government action. He seemed to be saying that there was a duty of the government to act and had not acted yet. Government acted in that it accepted his request, it determined that he could not be interviewed because he was incarcerated, sent him a letter saying it was being held in abeyance.
If we were to construe this as not just a request for action, any action, but a request for a specific action and to allow him to renounce, you would agree it's not moot then, right?
Well, it would then turn on the question of whether or not there's a clear, indisputable duty.
If it's a mandamus case. What if his claim is that it is arbitrary and capricious and a violation of equal protection to not let me renounce my citizenship? That doesn't require indisputable duty. That just requires that the government be wrong.
Well, we certainly concede that the government, that the district court did not view this as an action involving 7062 arbitrary and capricious. There's no question about that. The problem with viewing it in that sense is, as I indicated, there's no final agency action. As you correctly pointed out, that's not a jurisdictional issue. We would just say that that's not what he appears to be saying.
Well, doesn't final agency action comprehend also action unreasonably withheld or delayed?
That would be 706.1, and that's why that's an APA action in the nature of mandamus. But if I understood your colleague correctly, what he was saying is that this action, whether or not this should be construed as an action under 706.2, record review for a final agency action. With respect, if this is viewed as a 706.1, we would say, again, that there doesn't seem to be a clear, indisputable duty, and you can look at the statute, just if you look at 1481.
And have we said that that's imported into 706.1?
I'm sorry?
Have we said that a clear and indisputable duty is imported into 706.1?
Well, yes, that's how we view, we cited the Lee case, which also talked about the Norton case, that it has to be something that was historically enforced in the nature of mandamus, that it had to be a duty of that clear, of that type of clarity, and that's why we think it's appropriate to look at the language.
Our track decision arises under 706.1, doesn't it?
Correct.
Okay, so if this were a 706.1 case, there would be five or six factors listed in track.
Correct.
Which the district court would want to hear argument on both sides.
Okay. And evidence would have to be supplied on that. So to the extent that the position is actually that action is being unreasonably held, that would be correct. But there would still need to be some duty, and to the extent that the claim is he has a duty, or the government has a duty to adjudicate his request without an in-person interview, we think that fails as a matter of law simply by looking at the statute, that there is a merger of between the merits and jurisdiction that's recognized in the name Cheney, when there's it's in the nature
of
the
equal protection part.
Sorry?
What about the equal protection aspect?
Well, let me briefly address that. The problem with that, the reason we believe he lacks standing, is there's no nexus between the provision and his argument that an in-person interview is unconstitutional. That is, these are two unrelated concepts. The provision 1481A6 does not require an in-person interview. And thus, even if this court were to find that it were unconstitutional for USCIS to have this practice, this in-person interview, that would have no bearing on whether 1481A6 is constitutional.
Then it would make your action unconstitutional.
It would.
That and he had no way to know that this was your rationale, because the letter that you said you sent to him turned out was never sent to him until after the complaint was filed, right?
Correct.
So why can't we construe, or at least have the district court consider, whether the government is acting constitutionally by requiring that? Your position then is that it's not the statute, but that it's your agency's decision that requires an in-person interview. Is that right? Is that what you said?
The agency has a degree of discretion that it's not spelled out by the statute. What is the actual process that the agency must use?
So then the target should be the agency's unconstitutional act.
That's correct, but that doesn't seem to be the relief that's actually being
sought. Well, that's because he didn't know. Isn't that right? He didn't know at the time.
That's a fair point, but a pro se litigant can't have it both ways. He can't raise a new claim on appeal and then say that the district court erred in failing to consider the claim.
Well, can the government have it both ways? Actually, it seems like the government wants it five ways here. The government first wanted an explanation below that that only the foreign element of the statute applied to him, and he wasn't foreign. Then the government said the in United States version applies, but the only argument that the government made below in that respect was about national defense, right? That's what the affiant below said was the reason for the need for an in-person interview, correct?
Correct.
You're not making that argument on appeal, are you?
Well, Well, that's one of the reasons, but it's not.
You're not making that argument at all on appeal because I didn't see it in your brief anywhere. Your argument on appeal is you needed it, the in-person interview, because you want to know it's voluntary. Isn't that right?
And intent, both intent and voluntary.
All right, but neither of those have anything to do with the national defense. You don't mention the national defense in your brief.
I don't believe so, no.
Right, so you want it at least three ways then here.
Well, there's multiple rationales for
yes, but not the rationale that the agency itself relied on in the letter it sent to him or in the affidavit it sent to him.
That's correct, but it's trying to develop a process in against the context of litigation.
Then that's like the perfect example of why we need to remand this, so that the process that the government has developed, it can argue in front of the district court. It can't keep changing its position and then claiming that the pro se litigant didn't guess what its new position would be.
Well, the process is not really the issue, the rationale for why the agency yeah. determined why we need an in-person interview. It looked to what the procedures that the State Department had developed in applying an analogous provision. That's really not the issue. The issue was whether or not the government had acted, and we had acted. We had determined that that he was incarcerated and will be until August of this year, and therefore there was a need to hold it in abeyance, determine that was the most appropriate course of action.
You had a rationale, right? At least your current rationale is you want to ensure voluntariness, right? That's your current rationale.
And intent. And we have multiple rationales, but yes.
Well, what if they're all arbitrary and capricious or unconstitutional?
Well, we don't view this as a challenge to the 7062 challenge to the requirement to have an in-person interview.
Well, that's what he's challenging, isn't it? He's challenging the requirement of having an in-person interview for a prisoner who can't show up in person.
Well,
isn't that his argument?
We saw it as more of a mandamus claim that there's no duty.
I know you saw it that, but the words no duty are not in his complaint, nor is the word mandamus. Right?
There's no question. Equal protection are in the
equal
complaint.
Protection are,
which
though.
Which could be resolved not only by determining whether an in-person interview is an unconstitutional requirement, but also by determining that the interview, if reasonable, must be provided at the prison.
Well, I guess there's multiple ways of looking at the complaint, but the most fair reading of it is he's seeking to compel the government to act. The government has acted.
And he's saying also that he's being treated disparately because he's a prisoner, right? With regard to that, he's being deprived of a fundamental right because he's a prisoner.
Right? And the district court properly said that he does not have standing to raise that.
The district court rather peculiarly said he's being deprived. It's a privilege. He's not being deprived of anything. He's being his requirement with the delay in his renouncing his American citizenship is a gift. Right? It's a wonderful thing.
Well,
to be an American citizen.
It is a wonderful thing to be a citizen. I would say that there might be situations where someone could plead specific facts showing a concrete injury in fact stemming from the fact they remained a U.S. citizen. Perhaps you could have a plaintiff say they're suffering some adverse tax treatment or they cannot apply for some type of employment opportunity overseas because of the delay in their request for renunciation. But those facts are never alleged.
Why does it have to be that? Why can't it just be that he finds it negative? This may surprise all of us and everybody in the room, but he thinks it's a negative thing to be an American citizen. Why isn't that a burden on him that gives him standing? Now, he may lose, but I don't understand why that's not an injury to him from a standing point of view.
Well, our view was simply that because U.S. citizenship has been described as a precious gift, that simply saying, I don't want to be a citizen anymore is not enough, that he would have to plead some additional facts.
Well, most people think that marriage is a precious gift, but, you know, the Supreme Court has said that if you can't file for divorce because of, let's say, a filing fee, and you can't afford the filing fee, then that's raises constitutional problems. You know, my wife's not here, but so I will say that marriage is always a precious gift, but the Supreme Court says, you know, getting out of it is also a right, right?
I see my time has expired. May I have 30 seconds to respond?
You may.
The fundamental problem with the standing is that there's not a nexus between what claim he's trying to assert and the relief that he's seeking. You made some good points with respect to marriage, but that is the fundamental problem. There's this fundamental disconnect in the claim that he's trying to litigate. Thank you, Your Honor.
Can I ask one more question? I'm sorry.
Yes, Your Honor.
Just hang out there for a second. I was surprised to hear you say that you take the position that it is not the statute but the agency's decision that requires in-person appearance. I thought in the 28J letter you filed with respect to the Kaufman case that the government is taking the position that this is your interpretation, a reasonable interpretation, but nonetheless an interpretation of the statute. Isn't that right?
Yeah. We did not file the 28J letter.
Oh, the other side filed it. Sorry.
That's correct. It's a reasonable interpretation because it did not spell out the process. We reasonably filled in the gap. The language talked about designating an officer and prescribing a form, and this is the process that USCIS came up with while looking to the Department of State for guidance as spelled out.
So when he challenges the constitutionality of the statute as you interpret it, isn't that a reasonable attack on the constitutionality of the statute?
Well, that's a close call, but we would say no. It seems to be something that is unrelated to the nature of that is whether or not USCIS can have an in-person interview. It seems to be a distinct question from whether or not the statute itself is constitutional.
Okay, thank you. I believe the appellant has some more time.
6 minutes. I'd like to briefly address the construction of Mr. Schneitzer's complaint, especially his equal protection claim. Mr. Schneitzer states on A63 of the appendix that it is not his intent to file under the Mandamus Act, that the prison gave him one form, which was a 1983 form. And so the narrow construction of Mr. Schneitzer's claim is under the Mandamus Act really only serves to provide the government with a way that it can be mooted out.
Where's the place where it says that that gave him a 1983 form?
If you look on A63, mm-hmm. There's one that says under analysis, and it states the government claims that I filed this under 1983. When an inmate files any lawsuit, the court and the staff only give us one type of form. Regardless of this, I have a clear right not to be a United States citizen, and the United States gives me no available remedy because I am in prison.
Okay, thank you.
He also challenges both the laws and, after he's notified of the in-person interview, the policies that the government has created. On A67, he states, the relief I'm seeking is to have the court act in making the United States recognize my relinquishment and or declare the laws and policies used by the defendants for relinquishment unconstitutional. So he's challenging all of those things, and the fact that he only knows to challenge them after the government has informed him of the requirement doesn't indicate or doesn't justify construing his complaint so narrowly.
Could you just repeat that page site?
67.
And you're talking about the second line down? Beginning
yes.
With the second line down.
The relief I'm seeking.
Is this point raised in your brief? This is really problem here is really one of claim construction or the interpretation of the, I don't mean to use a patent term, but I mean the interpretation of the complaint?
Well, our brief does state that his complaint should be construed liberally, and we believe that that's something that should be done.
Construed liberally to say what we've been discussing, or to just say simply that he's not received all the relief he has requested?
Our brief also includes that it should be construed as against the policies of the United States, if that is the proper thing that he should be challenging at this point in time, given that he now knows about the in-person interview policy. Policies, just like statutes, can be unconstitutional.
That's not necessary to your prevailing, though, is it?
Yes, absolutely. Because
yes, it is necessary.
Oh, it is not necessary. I'm sorry. Because the district court simply stated that he lacked standing. And so what he is challenging specifically would be something for the district court to decide upon remand. But all of the government's arguments here still are going to the merits and not jurisdiction, whether or not their policy is reasonable or how they created it. Those are all issues that the district court should evaluate, and the fact that the government continues to give changing justifications, including now referencing whether or not...
But surely the first point made earlier by Judge Wilkins was correct, right? That a peek at the merits is unavoidable, that claim of a ministerial duty.
Yes. It is true.
He's not claiming to be... He's not asking for relief from the force of gravity. It's not a frivolous claim. But we can tell that only by looking at it from the point of view of the merits.
Yes, but there has to be a meaningful evaluation of the merits. And in this case, there is reason to believe that Mr. Schnitzler does have a right to renounce his citizenship while in prison, and that the agency's policy is, as Gainham puts it, tantamount to doing nothing, because it appears to operate to block his ability to use the statute. There are no more questions.
Questions? Thank you. We'll take the case under submission. Mr. Goldblatt and Ms. DeGeneff, you were appointed by the court as amicus. We're grateful for your assistance.